During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Well, we were going to have Blanca Simpson on this morning, but she's MIA. So that's where we're at. So this morning, what we're going to do is get your questions, and we're going to talk about what is happening here as Alec Murdaugh is going to be getting a new trial, unless something crazy happens between now and then, which, you know, in this case, I guess anything is truly possible. So go ahead, drop your questions and your thoughts on this as we kind of work our way through what the future now holds in the world of Alec Murdaugh, because I think to really fully understand this, we have to grasp it's not just here's a retrial and we're going back in and everything that was known in the first trial is going to be known in the second. That's not at all where this is. What's actually happening here is it's been set back to square one, as if Alec Murdaugh had just been charged. That is key, because there's so many things that are now on the table. And the AG in South Carolina, who is also running for governor, made a statement last week to, I believe it was Fox News Digital. I could be wrong on where he made the claim. But it was essentially saying all options are on the table when asked about the possibility of the death penalty for Alec Murdaugh. Now, it's not. There's a big difference here in saying pursuing death penalty and on the table. Two totally different things. On the table means, well, anything is possible. Anything is on the table. Pursuing, that's actively saying, yep, that's what we're going after. Can they even go that far? Many legal experts would already argue and say that that may not necessarily be something that can truly be pursued. But we'll tackle that a little bit later in the week with some of our attorneys. Joining me this morning to discuss, my co-host, Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, let's start with talking about Alec Murdaugh and the fact that he's getting a new trial. Just that news in general. When that came down the other day, what was your initial reaction?
I think me personally was more shocked than a lot of people were. I was kind of thinking that because of Becky Hill having been charged and all that, I was thinking it was almost resolved or pretty much resolved. And all our legal beagles on our show were not surprised by it, because I didn't really realize that all the financial side of it was also going to be challenged as well in appeal. So, the amount of coverage they spent on it. So not surprised. My initial, again, like everyone else's, my initial thing I did when I first saw it and heard it was, is he still in jail? Because are the financial crimes going to hold up? Because innocent until proven guilty-ish a second time, I guess. But I'm still glad he's guilty of all the other stuff to keep him off the streets and away from people.
I mean, the financial crimes, those are pretty solid. The fact that he pled to them, there's just so many things that then go up into the air here with Alec Murdaugh and what happens next. And I'm always surprised. There's so many cases where we think, oh, here's the potential paths of where this could go. And I'm always surprised sometimes by last minute where suddenly, oh, there's this other path they could go down. And I'm wondering and I'm waiting to hear what that's going to be and if there's any way of this affecting the financial crimes legally. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if there's a mechanism where because this is null and void, then that was what inspired him to then plead over here. And I know Eric kind of hit on that the other day of the possibilities of where that goes. I really wonder. I feel like there's, with this decision, the 5-0 statement and ruling and opinion from the Supreme Court of South Carolina. I mean, that's 5-0. I mean, they're pretty much dead set on this didn't work out right.
Right.
So what other dominoes that fell further down the line can be attributed back to this that also need to be reset or if they even can be reset?
Yeah, and from what we're seeing and from what Eric said, and we'll see what Bob says about it tomorrow if we cover it with him as well, is that, yeah, it looks like the financial fraud side is solid still. So he, but again, you know, because we've seen so many different machinations on the legal side and all the cases we've covered in the last couple of years, it makes you cringe, doesn't it? Because you're like, what are they going to do? We've seen crazy crap before happen, but the thing I think that's going to be different this time around is they're going to have to shift motive up or intent that he had. And I think because of people like Blanca have come out more very vocally and more theories, you know, people, I think defense is even hinting at DNA. I think we're going to see more of the same, but a lot more in this trial, hopefully, just with other possibilities. And also, I'm very curious about the fear factor here. You know, inside the world of Alec Murdaugh in South Carolina, that family had a brand that had a name that was very intimidating to people. And I think very much like the Diddy case, a lot of people were afraid to come forward because of the potential impact on them. And I'm very curious now that some time has passed, he's been behind bars. I'm very curious about what new people might come forward or at least have the courage to say more or something because of that. Feeling more safe, because remember, the greatest motivations for behaviors we have as a species is fear. And if fear is lifted because of a retrial, potentially, and he's already behind bars. In other words, it's not. So think about this. People will feel more empowered to do more and say more, hopefully, if they have more to say, because they don't fear, what if he's acquitted? What if they find him not guilty? He could be found not guilty of this, but he's still going to be behind jail unless something sideways goes with the financial crime side.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. I think a lot of people in South Carolina, in the Low Country, there was a level of feeling vindicated, a level of feeling secure and safe to tell more of their story. I'm wondering if that level of safety still holds for them with Alec Murdaugh having the conviction being thrown out. Obviously, the financial crimes, he's not getting out. I mean, the likelihood he'll ever get out, even if found not guilty here, is slim to nil. But, you know, just because you're behind bars doesn't mean that you don't have power. People from behind bars do have power. But it does feel, I would have to say, going into round two, I'm going to guess, and from everything we've heard from folks there, that power is down. The level is down. The level of concern is down. From reports that we've heard, just unconfirmed, his family's not visiting him. There's not a lot of people that are in Alex's corner anymore other than his attorneys. And I think that certainly means something, too, when it comes to debating whether or not you're going to be speaking out against Alec Murdaugh in some way, shape, or form, even if you're completely justified, because you don't know sometimes what some people will do behind the scenes. And Alec Murdaugh, obviously, behind the scenes, has a track record of doing shady things and had minions who were able to do that with him.
Yeah, and the things that drive fear are things he shouldn't have any more control of, you wouldn't think, and that is power and influence of decision and policymakers. So that was clearly something that was on their side when he was not incarcerated. And the other thing is money. It's gone. And the amount of which he got devastated financially because of his drug issues that he had and all these other financial horrendous things he was doing to individuals, you know, so that part's gone. So any influence he would have or manipulative tools he had are been, from what we can tell, completely abolished. And the name's been tarnished. As you said, people have been abandoning him. His family doesn't visit him. No one visits him. So hard to imagine a world where there should be fear in place of him, because no matter what, he's still behind bars. So I'm really hoping we see some new things. You know, prosecution is, like they said, the death penalty is on the table. Not that they're pursuing it, but, you know, be aggressive, be strong, and everyone involved in this, because I think the tendrils that the family had connections with through that fear factor probably went further than we saw in the first trial, and hopefully we'll see it more in this trial.
Well, politics are certainly at play here in this trial with Alec Murdaugh. I mean, the likelihood of this thing going to trial in 2026 is very slim to nil. And come next year, you're going to have a new AG in place. Now, the AG has already said, this is the one who just said, all options are on the table. Not I'm pursuing death penalty, but all options are on the table. The other folks who are running to replace him, all of them have said they will go after Alec Murdaugh. They will pursue a new trial. They haven't made statements specifically talking about pursuing the death penalty or even leaving it on the table. Only the one has said that, and that's the person who's running for governor, the person who's likely not going to even be overseeing any of this at the time of the trial. So it's interesting how Alec Murdaugh is almost single-handedly, inadvertently, likely going to affect the governor's race in South Carolina more so as almost a campaign promise, if someone were to look at it that way, of all things are on the table. And I'm wondering how much the AG making that statement is more so a basically weaponizing it, using the Alec Murdaugh case as a boon to vote for that person. Because, well, they believe Alec Murdaugh should die. And if you believe Alec Murdaugh should possibly die, then you should vote for me. I mean, essentially, without saying it directly, that seems to be the card that's kind of being played here.
It's interesting.
It is what it is. It's politics. But it's par for the course, I guess, in this area, or really anywhere, where you end up having politics weaponizing things that are not necessarily political, like a murder case, for benefit. I mean, we've seen it in other states, in other cities and whatnot, where someone's running for this or that. And sometimes these sort of cases can completely derail a campaign or very much hurt it. If you look at Philadelphia and you have the governor there trying to distance himself from the Ellen Greenberg case, right, and the decisions that were made, sometimes it can hurt you, but it can certainly also help you a lot too, as a rallying call of, we all hate Alec, vote for me. It's like, who hates Alec the most might be the person who wins the governorship of South Carolina next year.
Yeah, I'm definitely agreeing that politics is probably going to come into play with this, or they're going to definitely use it as a lever. It'd be interesting, if both candidates, I don't know how many candidates are running in South Carolina for this, but if the people that are running are smart on this, they will all go on the, we're going to get Alex reconvicted again, bandwagon. Because when you look at the sentiment of this, everything we're seeing, because I know some of the comments are coming in, you know, like, you know, is Buster, do we think Buster's going to testify? The family, why aren't they supporting? Are they supporting? I think the general thing we're seeing from everyone that's been close to the family and involved is everyone's pissed. Mm-hmm. And you're not quite sure why they're pissed, you know, but they are angry about this. And so you would think that that would translate into, hey, if poll numbers are saying everyone's pissed that there's a retrial, we better all get on the side of making sure it's a good retrial and he's reconvicted again, because of one greedy, abhorrent individual kind of sparked it. Again, I know when we talked to Eric Faddis last week, he's like, well, the financial stuff would have caused a most likely an overturn as well anyway, maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Becky Hill definitely was the impetus for really causing this to happen. So I think that's angered so many people that everyone is on the side of, hey, let's get him again. So, well, this will be really interesting.
What do you think is going on right now in the world of Becky Hill when she heard? Obviously, yeah, she's a free woman, but she had been convicted. She got probation and all that. I think in a lot of people's minds, the damage that was done and just the kind of slap on the wrist that you get for it was kind of insane. for the lives that have been affected, the millions and millions and millions of dollars that are going to be respent here, and people's time and energy and everything, just all of it, all because of her greed, all because she thought she wanted to sell that book. What do you think was going through her mind when this verdict came down? We all knew it was probably coming. We didn't know exactly what it would be, but what's your take? What do you think was going on when she got up in the morning and poured herself a cup of coffee?
Devastated. I mean, so Becky Hill, again, don't know her from a hole in the wall except for what we see on social media. She's not a person we would have ever seen on trial had it not been for this. She's not a murderer. She's not a bad person. She's a person I think got caught up, again, pure conjecture, most likely got caught up in the notoriety and the celebrity of what was going on, and got caught up in the cult of more and the disease of comparison. It's like, hey, I can capitalize on this. People have done this before. I'll write a book. Or Sears encouraged to write a book. Whatever it was, probably single-handedly the biggest regret of her entire life. And it ruined her life. It ruined everyone around her's lives. I mean, she can't be who she thought she was going to be, much like crimes change people's lives. Criminal activity changes people's lives. And she thought she was on the right side of the law for her entire life, obviously, until she wasn't. And she caused an amazing, devastating injustice that was done for the trial and now for herself and her family. Because I think she probably falls within a normal pattern of human behavior generally. Although obviously it spiked up with the greed got a hold of it, or whatever the notoriety that caused her to do what she did. But in general, I mean, how can she function and want to breathe and interact with the world? It's a tough place to be. I mean, I can't imagine it. I'm just glad that I have good, healthy people in my life that I don't have to deal with people like that.
Do you think that she's taking responsibility in her own mind, though? I mean, you know, or is she thinking, I didn't do anything wrong?
I don't know.
I would think she doesn't want to probably admit how wrong she was, but probably accepts the fact that she was. Because she's not had any pushback, because we're not seeing any self-centered narcissistic statements, because we're not seeing any victimization of herself to herself, you know, we're not seeing any mouthpieces coming from her, which is a good thing. The best thing she can do is shut the F up and just go away. And it would be really great to see, that would do her a lot of good, is a simple, I was wrong, I'm sorry, and then go away. You know, I mean, some sign of some sort of contrition and embarrassment, I think, would go a long way for public opinion. Because, I mean, if she played up not the victim, and she hasn't done anything yet, and just acknowledged that, hey, we're fallible, and boy, I suck. I mean, there's nowhere to go with it. In other words, when you validate someone's context of you, there's really nowhere else to go with it except, all right, then people move on. Because it's easy to pile on. So I think she probably, because again, I think she falls within that normal parameter of human behavior, probably an outlier in these moments. But people in the situation, when the whole world is saying you're an ugly duckling, the whole world, you do look in the mirror, but how closely she's looking is what is, I think, is the question.
Yeah, I wonder, and sometimes it makes you wonder if they're capable of doing that. You know,
we got little data points, little leakages from her. So, because I remember before she got convicted and tried, and I remember we're seeing some of the details of what she was doing in the courtroom and what she's doing with the jurist. You know, I've always viewed her as the mother hen. I know it's a bad analogy, but it's not to diminish her or anything, but, you know, kind of she saw, I think, in her mind, her role was to caretake the court.
Yeah.
And to caretake the jurors. And my thought process was, she probably has done it this way numerous times in the past. biggest case she's ever faced. And she probably felt compelled because this is her town, her community, you know, and all these things that she felt very attached to what was going on, attached to the outcome. She lost her objectivity that she should have as a as an officer of the court to do that. So I think she acted and had been acting prior to this out of a lot of compassion and caring towards others. And because that's of who she was, and it completely backfired on her, all these behaviors. In other words, I don't think this was an outlier behavior. I think it was this was her arc, you know, of doing these types of things, of taking care of the jurors, being coming personal, and it just backfired.
I think with a lot of people like that, though, they get into their own world of, I think I'm doing this because I'm being compassionate and I'm caring of others, and they're
fell in love with her, she fell in love with their own legend.
They're in love with themselves, and then they use that idea of that it's virtuous to be, you know, I'm doing this for you, I'm helping you, I'm giving you this information because I would want it. And it's like, no, you're just self-servingly trying to steer the ship because you can't not be in charge, and they hide behind that sort of shit. She kind of strikes me as that, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. So here's how these things typically happen in life. And we see people like this all the time, except they put a roadblock at a certain point, or they have loving critics that say,
and it's not covert that narcissism.
Yeah. Well, because what happens is this. So we can do our own little thought experiment, conjecture thought experiment. And that is, so here she is, first day on the job. And let's assume, again, I'm a glass half full with everyone, unless you're a serial killer like Coburg or something, that you're a decent human being. Decent human being, she gets this new job, she rises through the ranks, and she's excited. And she does probably an act of kindness during a trial or something. She takes care of a juror or jurist, and she gets some water, she gets lunch, or whatever she's supposed to do in her normal daily actions. And she gets validated by people saying, wow, you're really kind, you're really good. And so when you get that non-judgmental act of validation, what's going on in the big four in the brain? The serotonin, the oxytocin, the dopamine, endorphins, they're firing because I did this. And so what happens is you get addicted to that behavior. So it's like, wow, once you get one hit, I got to do a little bit more. And so they keep escalating up those staircases to get more of that hit, more of that hit, more of that hit.
Yeah.
And granted, they start out as very altruistic, good actions, safe, legal actions. But at a certain point, like you said, you start falling in love with your own legend, your own voice, and you get so addicted to that behavior and you keep going for that higher, higher hit. And you start thinking you actually have a bigger role and position, title, and influence than you're actually supposed to or do have. And you overstep the plate, the bounds, and the red line. And that's exactly what she did. She got addicted, hypothetically, conjecture on my side, got addicted to being overly involved than she should have. So she was blind to it because she's slowly boiling that frog over years or over a number of trials, and she undid herself.
Yeah, and I think when you have an environment where a lot of people are doing that simultaneously, it's like, well, this is just how we operate.
Yeah, and good old boys.
Exactly. It is. I mean, this damn case is really kind of goes back to the Reba song where it's like, don't trust your soul to a backwoods Southern lawyer. Is that the song?
I love country, yes.
It very much feels like that, where it's just, I mean, everything here, when we're talking earlier about the political end of this and all that, it just feels like everybody grabs onto the piece they want to use for their own motor, and they just go with it. And at the end of the day, it's like, well, then we kind of stop remembering what the purpose of this whole thing is about. It's about getting justice for two people who were murdered. It's not as a vehicle for someone's election bid or book deal or whatever. I mean, everybody has a lane that they're in, and it's just like none of them, I think, really truly are focusing on getting justice for Maggie and Paul, other than maybe Creighton Waters, the attorney. You know,
it's interesting. You know, when you think about what was going on in the case and how they're about to take down such a big name, that, you know, people that were going to really be heroes in this are the prosecutors, the judge who we loved. All these people are heroes. And I think she's trying to grab a slice of being a hero.
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
It's as simple as that. So she wanted to play a part in taking down this big name and share a piece. And now, granted, it's interesting if you think about it. the prosecutors, the judge, all Judge Newman, they were just being who they were. That's their role and responsibility. They weren't trying to be heroes. They were just doing their job. She, again, overstepped what her roles and responsibility were to try to be something that she wasn't supposed to be, and whammo. And that's why, you know, so I'm incredibly distraught that we have to retry this case. But at the same time, as the great Bob Motta will say, and Eric Faddis as well, I'm glad the criminal justice system is working like it did, because she went out of her lane and it screwed the entire case. It screwed our system, but the system's working that we're actually doing this.
I want to talk about another piece in the case here of Alec Murdaugh. Before we get to there, be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting your podcasts or watching us or listening to us. Links are in the description if you want to join in on the conversation. We will definitely continue it there. The South Carolina Supreme Court didn't just overturn Alec Murdaugh's conviction. They told prosecutors the first trial went too far on financial crimes and not far enough on the actual evidence of murder. We saw a lot of people testify in trial number one, including many a family member of Alec Murdaugh, some for the defense, some for the prosecution, some for both, and being asked to give their side of the story and what they knew for questioning on both ends. It's going to be interesting here to see who's on the stand in Alec Murdaugh trial number two and where their allegiances lie as we move into this. And I want to throw this out there for everybody in the comment section who's watching right now. And give me your thoughts. Who do you think from the family of Alec Murdaugh could be a very, very powerful witness, either for the defense of Alec Murdaugh in round two or for the prosecution? I'm really wondering here, now that we've had 3 years to simmer on this, and if the stories are true that most of the family has pretty much distanced themselves from Alec, not seeing him in jail, not communicating, kind of like, almost like he's dead in a way, or dead to them. A lot of them did testify in trial number one to them loving their brother Alec and that he could never have done something like this. You know, time has changed. Information it gets processed differently over time. And once you see the damage and the depravity of what Alec Murdaugh did to several people, it does make you wonder if there's going to be any of his brothers, anybody else in that family, his own son, that may have a different tune this time. Not that they're going to be adding information in that they didn't have the first time, but so, like I said, sometimes you look back on these things and go, yeah, that looks a little bit different to me. Maybe was this going on at the time before the murders and I was unaware of it, but when you put those pieces together, it makes a little bit more sense. Drop your thoughts in the comments section about who you think might be a very powerful witness here in trial number two. I'm going to go to you, Robin, on that one. Who do you think is going to really hold a lot of the cards towards Alec's freedom or continued incarceration here with the new trial?
Yeah, I think Blanca is going to play another key role in this, like she did last time, the housekeeper in there that knew Maggie and the family intricately, intimately for years, you know, like even to seeing his pill stashes all over the house. You know, that I think that is key and instrumental. I think obviously Buster potentially could be a bombshell in a lot of different ways for both prosecution or defense. What I think happens in these situations, I just dealt with this with a friend of mine as well. Hindsight with awareness is a very, very powerful weapon if you are a critical thinker. And what I mean by that is, so all the people that might have lined up on Alex's side to give testimony for him in the first trial, what happens is that once your image and your positive confirmation bias gets erased because of conviction, because of hearing new evidence or new details you never knew about an individual, because as soon as you have that aha moment when you see that someone's labeled an oxycodone addict or that they're, you know, psychopathic on a scale because of their inability to have any compassion, understanding, or remorse towards any other human being, then all of a sudden, all the data points that you rationalized and excused away in the past or even ignored because you're only looking at finding the good, all of a sudden, all these other data points come flooding in to give you the complete full picture of who this individual was. And then you have these aha moments and you're like, mm-hmm. oh. And so that's why I think right from the get-go, you're going to have a Blanca and potentially Buster. But I think there's a lot of other people that had the hindsight of being 2020 without the fear, without any other things that are coming in there for retribution or image, damaging their own self-image if you went against him. But just were close enough to be able to piece all these things together that is going to be able to give a clear arc of his behavior over time, because without being able to bring in the financial aspect as much as they did last time, because that actually displayed his life arc, the desperation of, you know, getting worse and worse and worse till he hit his critical point where, according to their theory, he killed his wife and son for sympathy, to delay tactics on collectors and all that weird stuff, right? But now, without that being able to be the linchpin, I think you have an ability to have a stronger base of people coming in to talk about that arc of sinking, of depravity, of getting lower, of how he treated people, to actually then bolster up that same. They can still go with, I think, the same claim of desperation with a lot more testimony of individuals without the hard stuff of the financial crime stuff in, you know, being part of it. Because remember, they're allowed to, as we don't know anything yet, really, but they're allowed this because it's definitely a part of it, but it just won't be 12 days of it.
Well, it makes me, sometimes time heals wounds. Sometimes it makes them worse. Sometimes it gives people time to simmer. It gives people time to really reflect on the extreme amount of damage that one individual has done.
Yeah, that's part of it, yeah.
To a system, to a family, if you will. And the trial was 3 years ago where he was found guilty. It was, a couple years after the actual crimes had been committed. But it was still, still fresher then than it certainly is now. I mean, when this trial two takes place, we're talking 7-8 years since the actual crimes would have been committed, if it happens around that point in time. And that's what I wonder about with something like this, when somebody does that level of damage to a family, to a name, how forgiving those family members are going to be. I mean, at moment of impact, you're still kind of trying to parse it through your mind. This person couldn't possibly do this. I love them. They love me. They've had this, they've played this role throughout life, and I've not seen this. But then to see, I mean, especially the reality, the financial crimes are all out there on the table. They weren't in the first trial. Now that's all been exposed completely. Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder, and I'm not speaking for anybody, but like your John Marvins and the other siblings of Alec Murdaugh, how many of them are, after a couple of years, after a couple of holidays, after a couple of years of experiencing the world, and every time you say the word, who are you? Murdaugh? Oh, you're related to Alec Murdaugh? And the disdain and the looks and the disgust and the shame that you end up starting to take on because of your brother, how much of that is going to be a motor and a motivating factor to try and bury their brother further into the ground, far deeper than the original hole was?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what is going to happen. And because people like Alex were extremely skilled at manipulation, subterfuge, deception, and whitewashing what they needed to for their own objectives, for financial fraud, for his addiction. And even someone in the comments said, I don't believe he's opioid addicted. Okay, that's even worse then, because there's no excuse whatsoever. I don't care.
Well, he was. I mean, I don't care what you believe. It is what it is.
Right.
It's like,
but either way,
kind of a fact.
Either way, extremely abhorrent behavior, right? Whatever the cause. And what happens over time is that, as like you said, as family members, people, and friends that are associated with the family have these discussions, have these dialogues. I mean, people sit around, and if you are a discerner of information and you are a critical thinker, I can only speak for myself because this is what I do every day. You are constantly trying to figure out what caused this, what caused this, what caused this. And so when you have that amount of time and some clarity of hindsight because of the first trial, over the period of time from the first trial to now, it's not that people stopped thinking about it. They had so much time to figure out what exactly was going on behind the scenes, and all these things started getting more and more unraveled. So I think they're closer to the truth of what he did now, probably back to them. Because back then, when you're under shorter time constraint, you're trying to come up with a theory. You're trying to come up with and understand the intent he had. And that intent might still be exactly the same, but now that it's had time to be flushed out with people that are angry, enraged, and even more sickened by his behavior and have transparency on actually what happened. I mean, how many times do people that hate someone get a redo to say what they actually learned since then? So instead of the glass half empty on this, in the sense of, oh my God, we got to do it again, this might be a glass half full. We actually might even see more people identified as victims than we saw in the first time. We're actually going to be able to see and understand and feel the impact, the negative impact of destruction of lives he's had, because people have been able to kind of figure out, oh, this was connected, this was connected. It's like when we do go up on a cell phone, you know, one of the ways we find all these other victims as well as cohorts in all these horrendous crimes is when you go up on a cell phone, you can actually see the linkages. This is the same thing that's going on behind the scenes now for the last couple of years, is people have been figuring out all these linkages that they might have been able to on the first one. So I'm a hopeful person on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things when you look at cases, like look at Corey Richens. That's what comes to my mind. Is if you're to look at her case 5 years from now, does she look any better to anybody? No, she probably looks worse.
Oh, my God.
But that's how it is. I mean, I'm thinking, I've talked about this on the air before, where that case is very triggering to me because it reminds me a lot of a situation I've been in. And when I look back on that in my own life years later, I'm not better. I feel like I'm mentally in a much better place, but I'm not in a place where I'm like more forgiving or I'm more just like enraged by the abhorrent behavior that I witnessed because things line up better. They make more sense, and you start putting more pieces together going, holy shit, that's a really monstrous way of behaving. And that's what I think is probably, I would guess, it has been happening within the Murdaugh family. That's my own conjecture, but I can't imagine everybody's like, oh, well, there was all these redeeming qualities of Alec. And I'm sure there was, but I'm guessing they're probably out the window by now.
And what happens is Tony, from your example, and the same thing with everyone tied to this, or anyone that's tied to any abhorrent individual, is you first understand the individual causing the great destruction of lives, right? The person at the center. But then you also start understanding and recognizing their behavior and how they impacted here, things that you didn't understand or see or recognize in the moment. What happens is you start recognizing the impact of that one individual in all these other different areas and all these other different other people and what that looks like to them. So what happens is when you give a label and a meaning to behaviors, it's what I call the new car effect. The day I bought my Toyota Tundra, poof, 300 people in my county here in Virginia bought the same car because it has a label and meaning, we recognize it. And so for you and for anyone, as soon as we see it once, you see the wobble, our behavior wobbles. And so you start recognizing behavior wobble, not just from the one individual. That's why it's easier after you go through the pain and suffering like you did once. You're always trying to see this one wobble here, this one person. But now, since that one person causes all the impacts, all these other people, you can actually see it further out. And you can see the impact over here. So to your point in your own life, you can see the wobbles in other people and how they're affecting further out. And so you can be more discerning, interrogate the information more. And same thing in Alex Murdaugh's life too. All these other people are now seeing the effect that he had here. Never thought about it before. And this is where PTSD comes from, is the collateral damage and impact from these things and all the wobbles that these horrendous people cause.
I mean, Alec Murdaugh is going to need empathetic figures in this trial speaking on his behalf. And I don't think that's the problem. I mean, that's the thing. But will that, I mean, it's a new balancing game on the weights that are going to be on all this, because it's certainly not going to be the same case. I mean, is that going to rebalance itself a little bit? You're going to have less empathetic figures over here on Alex's side, I'm guessing, but you're also probably not going to have 12 days of financial testimony either. So is, do you need that much in the basket over here to weigh? I mean, you'd certainly like it for Alec, or Alec would like it anyway, but is it going to be that necessary if we're not going to have as deplorable character type testimony coming to light as we did in round one? So again, it's all the calculation of the recipe to see how this thing turns out and what's going to be needed if we're going to get a conviction of Alec Murdaugh.
So, yes-ish. So they're using the financial aspects to demonstrate his deplorableness. Mm-hmm. But that's just an outcome of horrendous symptoms along the way. I think, like we've been talking about, the vastness of his deplorableness, that was just how it manifested, but it was there all over the place. And so I think, because again, all these other people that were involved with the hindsight and seeing the actions he was taking that led to the outcome of the financial stuff, all the deplorableness is there. Remember, when you see one thing, there's usually 10 things ahead of time that caused that one thing. So if you look at the financial crime as just one thing, there's probably at least 10 deplorable things he did underneath that led to that. And I think that's what's going to be part of it this time.
It's just, you know, the weight of it with a jury, 12 days of it being pounded in your head versus, you know, 12 hours, you know,
right. Pretty
different. I mean, so I don't know, the repetition of that to the jury, it's all going to come down to, is it quantity versus quality on where some of this is going to land. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work through it. New trial for Alec Murdaugh, it's likely going to be happening. No date or anything set yet. I know people are like, well, what if the state decides they don't want to? Well, the state's already said publicly, and everyone running for the position has all publicly said they're going to be trying Alec Murdaugh again. So unless an asteroid hits or something, who knows? I guess anything is possible. We're likely going to be seeing another trial of Alec Murdaugh. The only thing I think that would be preventing that would be death. So unless Alec kicks it between now and then, we're likely going to see another Alec Murdaugh trial.
That'd be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, again, anything's possible. The question is, what's going to be happening in a new trial? Will there be third party defense arguments being made? That's already been hinted at a bit by the attorneys for Alec Murdaugh. They were on television the day after the conviction was overturned and said that they have new information about third parties and potential motives, things that were not in existence in trial number one. If we go down the third party road, who are we talking about? And why, I guess, would be the question. Your thoughts in the comment section as we work through this. I'd love to get your reactions if you think we're going to see a third-party argument made here, meaning somebody else did this other than Alec. I'd be very curious for everybody's opinion on where that is, in fact, going to land. One of the things that I know Blanca Simpson had said that essentially she thought there was a plan A and a plan B that night. Plan A might have been that there was somebody else possibly involved in this. Plan B would be if they didn't show up and Alec had to do it himself. And was this a plan B? Was this a plan B? Was Alec, for whatever, I mean, if we're going back to the financial motives and you need to take out your family to get sympathy and empathy and your son's an F up and you're utterly ashamed of him every which way and he's essentially pulling and destroying your life by all of your finances that have now been exposed because of his actions, and your wife is ready to leave you, and then all of that stuff could be exposed in a divorce. It starts to make sense why he might have murdered his family. And not that it's justified or ever the solution, but if you're a twisted drug addict who's a narcissistic monster, in my opinion, which he might be, that might be the motive for him to do it. And if somebody doesn't show up and you got the weapons there and you go do it, you might, I don't know. Where do you think that goes? Do you think there's a way to get a plan B or to get a third party argument into this when it was not even remotely argued in trial number one, to a lot of people's surprise?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised it wasn't argued either. And here's why, because as soon as we started, you know, thinking about this, Tony, and over the weekend I looked at it, and I actually searched it through Blanca's book as well. The idea of someone else be involved, it's actually pretty plausible if you're looking at Alex's behavior arc. Never once, according to at least Blanca, throughout the course of her tenure there, did Alex ever do anything for himself. Never cleaned up, never took out the trash. I mean, never did anything himself. He's not a do-it-yourself kind of guy. He was always an outsourcer. And so if you just think about human beings and our behavior, the likelihood and laws of probability of him doing a solo act of something like this is pretty remote. It would be an outlier. It'd be a spike. So I think the idea of the concept of having a plan A and a plan B, it actually fits a behavior pattern I'd expect. And so the fact it wasn't introduced in ones because they had all the finance stuff to rely upon. But again, now that we have all that hindsight, all this conjecture, now anti that in my world is the fact that you've had no leakage that we know of anyway between then and now of other people potentially being involved. Because I would think people would throw people under the bus in that time frame since then, but maybe not. But maybe that's what we're going to find out in the next trial.
What do you think of that? The question that I see a lot too, why Maggie and Paul, but not Buster? Buster wasn't necessarily as readily available, I guess, could be one of the answers that evening. But I think it goes deeper than that. Buster was not actively causing a lot of shame for the family at that moment in time, or a potential threat to Alec, I think, more than anything else. Maggie, a divorce, threat, exposure. Buster, the trial that was going to be coming up for the boating accident, threat to Alec, exposure. Buster didn't present any threats to exposure. He was kind of off doing his own thing already. He seemed to be the one. I mean, granted, there was the college stuff, the cheating. But again, that really was, that was par for the course Murtaugh bullshit. We see these sort of things with wealthy families, entitled families, all the time, unfortunately, but not like shit that people go murder their families over. The other stuff, a little more volatile, I would say, in my opinion. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Robin?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is logistics, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I think logistically it's harder to go for all three than to two. And also to your point, it wasn't in the line of sight. You know, the ones that are potentially a threat or those two more than Buster. And also I think in his twisted drug-induced way, I think it would have looked more suspicious in his mind if all three were gone and not just two. Especially if he thought Buster might be his buddy on his side. I mean, I see right now, and I'm kind of cringing at what I'm saying for a few reasons. One, because I'm giving Alex the benefit of the doubt of thinking. And I don't think people like this think. I think they're completely abhorrent bags of bad genetic coding, right? And I don't think he's as contemplative as we're giving him credit for. So that's why I'm thinking it was probably logistical convenience more than anything else.
Yeah, it and plus too, I mean, if we're gonna get on the road of Alec was thinking of it, and I do think a lot of this was drug hazed
reaction.
Which I think led to bad choices, but if we're going to go down that road there of him thinking this out a little bit, okay, if Maggie's taken out, if Paul's taken out, and if they had taken out Buster too, why is Alec still alive? If he's right there, why wouldn't he have been taken out as well? That just doesn't make any sense. So I'm wondering if he thought too of, well, but then of course we go down the road a little bit further. And then we have the attempt on his life on the side of the road with Cousin Eddie, where that was supposed to look one way and didn't look that one way. Drug fueled. I mean, just utterly chaotic and everything that was that moment in time. I'm wondering how that plays into this case, this round, in terms of Alex thinking and motivation and Cousin Eddie in general, and what he has to say about all this. He did not take the stand in the first trial, curiously. I'm wondering if we will see some interesting testimony from him this round.
Yeah, it will be interesting. I bet we probably will. Why wouldn't we? It's hard to imagine people not wanting to testify if they're called upon to testify. I tell you, just the life cycle of these people is just pretty remarkable.
It is. I mean, it really is, to see where exactly they all go in terms of the direction that they're motivated.
And I'm trying to look at the word I just wrote down too. You know what I don't get on this, Tony, that we see in every other case? If he was so financially strapped, again, this is why I don't give his intelligence all that get much credibility. And granted, not that this is super smart, but you will at least we've seen it in every other case. Why weren't there life insurance policies? Except on him. I mean, how stupid. So just think about the stupid brain. Stupid people do stupid things, right?
Yeah.
He's got a life insurance policy on him. And so the only way to make money is to have himself bumped off for his kids, but he's got no life insurance on them. And so he's going for a sympathy theme. What? I mean, you see the chaos of stupid brain here? Mm-hmm. It makes no sense whatsoever. Even Lori Vallow took out life insurance policies on people before she bumped them off. You know, and so that's why for someone to use, that's why it'll be really interesting what they come up with, a prosecution on this one, because his broken brain somehow or other kept thinking twice, according to, you know, the second, the trial on this, but on the second attempt of taking lives, first one on his cell for a sympathy theme. And this one, same motive, according to the prosecution, was a sympathy theme for delaying tactic so he can get money to pay off this immense debt. What? I mean, think about this. Corey Richens had insurance policies out. And granted, her insurance policies wouldn't even cover her debt that she had. Oh, just what a bunch of lunatics.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm wondering, how much... And I wonder how much more drugs are going to be brought into this trial. I know they brought him up the first time. I'm wondering if they're going to rely on it more as any sort of motivating factor, or because if they're going to say, I don't know how you even go down that road without saying he did it, because he says he didn't do it. But other than explaining why he doesn't know what happened, is that it? I mean, the drama that was done of it, the Murdaugh murders. I'm not talking about the documentary. I'm talking about the mini series that came out based on that reporting from Matney and all that. They leaned really heavily into the drug area of the story, and yes, some of it was dramatized without a doubt. But I mean, if Alec was as much of an addict as he was portrayed there, a lot of this makes sense, because none of it does make sense.
Yeah,
that's really the nonsensical nature of all of this makes sense when you say drugs were involved.
Dope brain.
Yeah.
What was the amount that, and was this in testimony or was it in the documentary? $50,000 a week.
It was insane. I mean, it was like, it was beyond what anyone could actually take.
I don't know the
street. Without dying.
I don't know street value of anything like that, but $50,000 a week, that's a lot of pills, I would think.
There needs to be more explanation here. There needs to be more investigating here as to what the hell was going on. Because I think, quite honestly, at the end of the day, if Alec did not do this, I think the answer to who did lies somewhere in that circle of how the hell he was spending egregious amounts of money on pills, so much more money than anyone could ever consume without dying. I mean, this is like, I mean, it's enough to like kill a zoo, you know?
Kill a zoo.
It is. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, I know.
It does not make sense, but it's like an unanswered question that lies out there in the ether in this case. And everybody's just like, oh, wow, he spent that much on drugs? Like, yeah, that makes no sense at all. He's not consuming that many drugs. And he clearly wasn't like hoarding them somewhere in Moselle. So where is it going? Where are they all going? And why was there no like explanation for any of this? Why was this just kind of like settled of, oh, he just spent that much money on drugs? Like, if there was anything else he was buying that much of, like if he were spending that much money on weapons in a week, they'd be figuring out where the fuck he bought that many weapons from. But with the drugs, it was just like, spent a lot of money on dope. Like, yeah, I think that may that circle there, whoever is involved in that circle doesn't want that circle explored.
So I'm going to throw my, I never do this either, Tony. I'm going to put my foot in it. My conspiracy theory side, right, for alternative possibilities that the defense might try to do. It'll be interesting. So here's a dude that was in debt up to his eyeballs, probably to his drug dealers as well. So the drug dealers either threaten him to kill the family or take out the family, thinking that the family had life insurance policies that they could actually pay, that he could use to pay them back with.
That's an interesting thought.
But he's still at the center of it.
Well, look, pattern of behavior here too. Mm-hmm. I mean, Alec was screwing people out of money left and right that he viewed as being less than him, his clients and such. Does anybody think for a moment that Alec Murdaugh wouldn't be screwing over his drug dealers too, who he would probably view as less than him? So it does make you wonder if maybe somebody there got really fucking pissed. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm 75% on that Alec did it himself. I'm 25% on that there's somebody else involved here. Alec is involved in the circle.
Yeah, I think he's the center spoke of the hub of the wheel.
Yeah.
But again, if you're looking at Pass's prologue with him, he's never done anything solo. He's always had handlers. And so I'm curious about how that'll play into it, including his drug dealing handlers. Well, like, where the hell do you get all these pills? Well, where do you get $50,000 worth of pills a week?
Well, it just makes me wonder again. I mean, it goes deeper, I think, because it's okay. I don't think it would be that hard to dig and find out who those people are or why they were involved in the way that they were. There's a reason those doors have not been opened.
I know. It's interesting, isn't it?
And that's the question in my mind. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. Go and check this out. And buy it or audiobook it as well. Available on Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks.
Thank you.
Until next time, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.